Well, I'm in this sermon series called Dealing With It, Facing It, and I'm almost done dealing with it. Okay? We talked about dealing with depression, then dissatisfaction. Today is dealing with failure, and next week is dealing with bitterness. And I said to Kathy, surely next Sunday's not Mother's Day, right? And she said, no. I thought, what a Mother's Day sermon if it's on dealing with... But the day of Mother's Day, I'm talking about facing extremism. So mothers can be a little extreme at times. Maybe that's how I'll get us started, you know. But anyhow, then we're going to move on to, you know, some other subjects. But dealing with failure. Shaphat. Shamua. Caleb. Egal. Joshua. Palti. Gadiel. Gadi. Amiel. Sether. Nabi. Gul. Those are 12 names of men in the Bible, or 12 men's names in the Bible. Did you recognize any of them? Probably two. Joshua and Caleb. Those are the names of the 12 spies that Moses picked to go on into Canaan, the land that flowed with milk and honey, to spy out the land while the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness. And I want to look in on their lives today. Let's go to Numbers chapter 13 and then part of chapter 14 today. And I'm stuck for some reason up there, if you can help me out. Okay, Numbers 13 and then part of Numbers 14. We'll pick up in Numbers 13 and verse 21. So, see what we can do to get that moving up there. Numbers 13:21 says, "And so they," that's those 12 men I just mentioned, "they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin to Rehob near Lebo Hamath. And they went into the Negev and came to Hebron. Ahiman, Shishai, Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were there." Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. "And they came to the valley of Eshcol, and they cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between the two of them, and they also brought some pomegranates and figs." And see, what we're seeing here is they left that sketchy, stark, barren wilderness and went into their future home. And there was a lush green valley with giant produce. And the cluster of grapes was so big, it was easier to put a pole between two men's shoulders just to carry that one cluster of grapes. Now, in my mind, I don't see, you know, baseball-sized grapes. I see bigger than usual grapes, but a cluster, you know, as big as a man. And could you imagine what the pomegranates look like? And imagine what the figs look like? And that place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster that the people of Israel cut down from there. And at the end of the 40 days, they returned from spying out the land. And they came to Moses and Aaron to the congregation of the people of Israel at Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them, to all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. Now, can you imagine these dozen men put their life on the line, spied out the land, they come back with this giant produce. What we would think if we were part of the people of the nation of Israel going, "Whoa! No way! Where did you get that?" And they said, "Guess what? It's lush. It's beautiful. It's big." And it says, verse 27, "And they told him, we came to the land to which you sent us. It does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw all the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the hill country. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and all along the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Now, we do know that Joshua joined in with him and said, "Yes, we can." And the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people. They're stronger than we are." And I take a little snapshot of a scene like that. It reminds me a lot of church board meetings, you know, where I have this great idea. "We can do it." "No, we can't." No, that's not really how it works. But you ever been in that position where you had a vision from God and you just knew it's what to do and you shared it with this person, and pretty soon it's like, "That was the dumbest idea I ever had. Why did I even bring it up?" Okay, they said, "We can't do it." And it says they brought up to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we've gone to spy out, it's a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim." They were known to be giants. Okay, but, you know, a giant of 7'5", not a 20-foot man, you know, just bigger than the height of a door. You know, doorways, if you don't know, are 6'8" typically. That's a pretty high guy, you know, when somebody comes through and has to duck their head to get in the door. And to them, you know, they're like giants. And here's what they said: "And we seem like grasshoppers to ourselves, and so we seem to them." Now, you could go back and read all of those names: that Shemua, Shaphat, Palti, Gadiel, Gadi, Sethur, Nabi, Bul. Of all the names, I like that one. Bull. Okay. "Hey, bull, come here." Okay. All of those guys, they had the defeatist attitude. And I call that the attitude of failure. And 2 out of 10 said, "We can do it," and had the attitude of success. And so as we talk about dealing with failure, I want you to know that attitude has a lot to do with how you'll handle life and handle failing in life. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 8 and verse 4, the scripture says that God says to Jeremiah to tell the people, "This is what the Lord says. You know, if a man falls down, he gets up again. And if a man goes the wrong way, he turns around and comes back." And God was reasoning with the people of Israel to say, "Hey, you know, if you went the wrong way, turn around. If you fell down, get up. We don't stay down." And so today I want to share with you 5 wise insights about failure and success. The first one is this: everybody fails sometime in their life. Whether we like it or not, okay, whether we think it's true or not, when we start out young, we think, "I may never fail," but that really is true. Proverbs 24:16 says this: "The righteous may fall 7 times, but still get up, but the wicked will stumble into trouble." And so even the best of men, the best of women, fail at times. You know, life is risky. Everything out there is a risk. And I developed a little list of how to never fail by avoiding risk. Here's my advice. If you never want to fail, if you don't want to take any risk, first of all, never drive a car. And don't travel by air or railroad or by sea, because things happen when people travel. Am I right? And besides that, don't ever walk on the street, or don't even walk on the sidewalk, because sometimes cars will come up there and get you, even when you're on the sidewalk, you know. And do you know that most accidents happen within 2 or 3 miles from your home? So just move, right? No, really. Do you know 18,000 Americans die every year from accidents in their own home? Can you imagine that? Whether it's a fall or accidental poisoning or purposeful poisoning, you know, whoever did it to you kind of thing, called supper sometimes. No. And Do you know 21 million medical visits to the ER happen every year because of an accident in the home, and about $220 billion a year of medical costs are encountered because of home accidents. So I'd say if you don't want to take a risk, if you want to make sure you never fail, don't stay home if you don't want to fail. And you know, breathing is a risk, right? I mean, you might catch something if you breathe. So I guess the only way to avoid risk is just don't breathe. And of course, then you fail. So I guess you can't avoid it. Well, years ago, Pastor Erwin Lutzer wrote a book. He called it Failure, the Back Door to Success. And I want to share just a couple paragraphs from that book. He says, there are many causes for failure. Some are the product of the specific acts of sin, but some are not. Some failure is the product of ignorance or the circumstances beyond our control, like a drop in the stock market or extreme weather conditions like a drought or a flood, which could cause a farmer or a rancher to lose his shirt. But even though it's not his fault and he loses his shirt, he feels like he failed, doesn't he? And he goes on to say, naturally, this kind of failure, as serious and painful as it is not as serious as spiritual failure, like, for instance, the sin of David. When David did recover from his sin, while David did recover from his sin and was still used of God afterward, there were lifelong consequences in his life and the lives of others. And I think that's true. When I look at my life, the times that I have fallen, the times that I have failed, sometimes it didn't have a whole lot to do with the things I did wrong or the things I didn't do right. Sometimes it just came upon me. And other times I could look back and say, you know what? You better get yourself back in line with God because, you know, this might be His hardship, His discipline in your life. And so we know that it comes both ways. And I'm so amazed at David. How far did David fall? Whew. He was a king that had a whole kingdom. And more than one wife. And he wanted that guy's wife. And he took that guy's wife. And then he covered it up because he got her pregnant. And he got her husband murdered. And then in his own family, there was incest and there was murder. And David even grieved the death of the son who was trying to take his father's throne. And so we say, what a failure. But what's his nickname in the Bible? A man after God's own heart. And I just got to tell you, God is not nearly surprised by our failure as we are. See, some things shock us. Nothing shocks God. And then Lutzer goes on and he says, whether caused by sin or by the many things that can happen beyond our control, all failure teaches us this important truth. Just how desperately we need God and His mercy and His grace for life. So whether we brought it on or whether it just happened, it still says, I need God. Some of our failures are mirrors of reproof, but always they can become tools for growth and deeper levels of trust and commitment to God. So get this down. Everybody fails at some point in their life, and God is adequate for every failure. Whether our fault, whether we had not much to do with it, our failures, see, are no surprise to God. Truth number two, failing does not make you a failure. See, failure is not final. Think about characters in the Bible. If you had to pick a character that would represent failure, who would you pick? Somebody like Abraham, who second-guessed God and had a relation with his wife's handmaiden and tried to, you know, speed up God's plan? Or would you pick somebody like Moses, who led the people of Israel, and then he took things in his own hands, and what did it cost them? The leader of the whole pack didn't get to go into the promised land. Or would it be somebody like David or Elijah? You know, he won the great victory with the prophets of Baal. What a success. And then he went. Or Peter. I would just say, think of any Bible character that you see failure in their life, and you'll find this, that God put every one of those people back on track after they failed one way or another. Their common story was, failure was not final. Now, I think when we look at the Bible, the greatest failure, the greatest pattern, example of failure was Adam. I mean, think about it. He had everything handed to him, and he just had like this one rule. Just don't eat the fruit of this tree. And what tree did he have to have fruit from? That tree. I mean, he could have eaten the fruit of 1,000 other trees or 10,000 other trees, just not that one. I mean, he lived in paradise. Now, here's a common way of saying, a common man's way. He ran around the jungle naked, and he was told to go make babies. I mean, that was his job, right? And he was born disease-free, and he would never die, and he always would remain virile. Now, who can have it better than that? And God said, just don't eat the fruit from that one tree, and that's exactly what happened. And that's not the worst of it. He brought a mess in all of time and all of history. Sin entered the world through Adam, and there now would be a curse upon all the people, upon the earth itself, and there would be pain and suffering and disease and death, all because of Adam. And I say, what a picture of failure. In my opinion. You know, as I was thinking that through, I thought, what if I meet Adam in heaven? What am I going to say to him? I mean, we characterize Adam and Eve as, you know, mom and dad and you know, the perfect couple. But right now I just feel like saying, what were you thinking? Look what you caused. So, anyhow, just keep thinking about that. Who would characterize, you know, failure to you? Now listen, concerning failure not being final, I want to get our thinking corrected. Let me ask you a question. Is success final? No. I mean, how many people you know who have succeeded in finances and lost everything more than once, or had the greatest family in the world and it fell apart, or, you know, was, you know, how many pastors have, you know, do you read about, been in the pulpit? Just last week they removed a big megachurch voice, Darren Patrick, because he was so full of pride and couldn't leave women alone. But he was a voice for the evangelical, dynamic, growing church, you know, and this weekend, he probably feels like a failure, but even though people might be done with him, God's probably not. But I just want you to know, success isn't final either. So the big deal is this, whether we succeed or whether we fail, we just have to keep going either way. Winston Churchill said this, he said, success is not final and failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts. Now mark this. We learn from our past, but we are not controlled by our past. Can you accept that? Do you hear that? We learn from our past, but we're not controlled by our past. So I want you to do a little introspection right now. What is it in your life that's made you feel like a failure? Maybe your parenting experience didn't turn out how you thought it would. And you've gone through a season, or you're going through right now saying, Lord, what a mess. I have failed. Or maybe a troubled marriage, or a marriage that ended in divorce. And you know, I think in the conservative evangelical church, there are two unforgivable sins. Blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, and divorce. But the Scripture does not make divorce an unforgivable sin. God does not desire divorce, but it's not the end of the world if you've been through a broken marriage. God's grace is greater. We don't need to get paralyzed by our past. Or the ups and downs of a career. Have you ever been fired? You don't need to raise your hand. How'd you feel the next day after that? See, but then you saw your way clear and found out that wasn't final. I'm not a failure. Or financial pressures. Who here's ever gone bankrupt? You don't need to raise your hand. Who's in over your head with, you know, payments? You don't need to raise your hand. Or who's caught in abuse or addiction? Or your own moral weakness has made you feel like a failure. But I just want you to understand, everyone fails at some time in their life, and failure is not final. See, here's how we need to talk about it. I have failed financially for now. See, I've failed relationally for now. I'm stuck in addiction for now. Because even when we think it's over, it's not over. Just remember the scene of Abraham about to give Isaac back to God after he was the son of promise, waited 25 years. He's some kind of a teenager, maybe 16, 17 years old. God says, give him back. Abraham says, okay. He packs up the wood. His own son carries it 3 days up the hill. Dad, where's the sacrifice? Son, God will provide. They build the altar. Abraham puts his own son on the altar. Knife in the air. See, he thought it was over. But it wasn't over when it was over. And God said, bah! Well, God didn't. The ram did. But God made the ram appear in the bush. And there was a substitution. The very picture of the cross of Jesus Christ. And see, you've got to know that God, He doesn't see it like we do. He comes through when we think, It's over. So I want you to know that when you're picking yourself up from failure and you're ready to give it another try, here's two things I want you to remember. Your limitations are limited. See, when we fail and we think, I'm going to try again, we think, I am so stuck. I can never do this. I can never do this. You know, if you failed finance, you think, I'll never buy another car on payments. I'll never be able to have a mortgage. If you failed with family, you think, I could never start over. But your limitations are limited. It's probably not as bad as you might think. And then secondly, just remember, it's not over till it's over. That God's timing is not our timing. God's thinking is not our thinking. And God's ways are not our ways. And I have to say this. If you're still breathing, it's not over. Number three, after failing, fear becomes the biggest factor to overcome. See, fear sets in after we fail, especially when we're ready to give it another try, because we don't want to repeat that course again. Right? I mean, if you had a business and you lost that business and you think, a few years pass, I'm going to try it again. You have to think twice to say, well, what if the same thing happens? Or if you were married and you're not married and you're thinking about getting married again, you think, oh boy, what could happen? And that's just normal. I mean, that's the way we think. What if I try and I fail again? Well, let me tell you something. Our fears are usually false. The things I fret about don't usually come to pass. How about you? And I've told you before, in Western Pennsylvania, I think we own worry. We think like this. If I think of everything that could go wrong and worry about it, then it won't happen. But if I don't think about it and worry about it, then it's going to sneak up on me and get me. And so it becomes our duty to worry. What if he takes the car? You know, what if? You know, we go on vacation and we use them. And what if? You know, and we just live by the what ifs, and it just hems us in and keeps us down. And then I would say sometimes it's clear that when we persist in our fearful what ifs, we tend to make them self-fulfilling prophecies. And then we say, I was right. I was right. See. Viktor Frankl said this, fear makes come true that which we are afraid of. See. Do you know in mental health there's actually a diagnosis for the fear of fear. It's called a tickophobia. And they define it this way, an abnormal, unwarranted, persistent fear of failure. It's a specific name, phobia. And they do prescribe medicine for it. I don't know that you necessarily need medicine for it, but the symptoms you might need medicine for. The symptoms of a tickophobia can include irregular heartbeat, shortness of breath, rapid breathing, nausea, overall feelings of dread, diarrhea, stomach disorders, flushing of the face, perspiration, muscle tension, tremors, and faintness. Now, you hypochondriacs probably think, oh, I got it, that's what I have, that must be what, I'm afraid of fear, I'm afraid I'm going to fail, what's going on, I had diarrhea last night, it must be fear in my life. Right? Well, here's my best fear verse. I consciously repeat it and practice it daily at the end of the day. 1 Peter 5:7, NIV, says, cast all of your anxiety on Him, for He cares for you. He's the burden bearer. He's not just the caregiver, He's the caretaker. See? And I tell them, tough times here, I just tell them, God, these are not my people, these are your people. Right? Shouldn't I? And Lord, I don't know how I'm going to get through this week, but You know how. And I'm not sure what's going to happen with this person or that, you know, issue or that problem, but I can't carry the load. That's up to Him. He is the one who takes my fear away. Well, I got to thinking this week. I'm not a great big sports fan, but, you know, I grew up playing some baseball. A couple weeks ago, I told you a little story about Chubby Bobby trying to steal home. You remember that story? I've had people remind me every time they watch baseball now and a guy gets on third, they think of Chubby Bobby. If you don't remember, I happened to make it to third base one time when I was young. Probably more than once, but just one time I did. And the base coach is right there, and I'm ready to steal home. He's, no, and I went, phew! And I got out, of course. You know, but I just think of that. But I got to thinking more about fear and baseball, and I looked up some statistics. In 2016, right now in Major League Baseball, so far, the batting average champion is Daniel Murphy of the Washington Nationals. He's batting a .411 right now in Major League Baseball. And that's really good for baseball. He's been up to bat 56 times this year, and he's gotten to base 23 times. So 4 out of 10 times he hits the ball and gets himself on first base. But you know what else that means? 6 out of 10 times, he doesn't get to first base. Statistically, is he a failure or is he a success? I mean, when you think of it inversely, his failure rate is a 589. And his success rate is a 411. Now, in his 8-year batting average in the Major League Baseball, he has a 290. That means over 8 years of playing baseball, 3 times out of 10, he gets to base. And that means 7 times out of 10, he doesn't. Now, last year, he played for the New York Mets. They made the World Series. He got up to bat 20 times in the World Series, and he got to base 3 times. He batted a 150. That means his failure rate was a 850 in the World Series. Statistically, is he a failure or a success? Now, I already told you he got up 56 times to bat so far this year. And out of those 56 times, 8 times he completely struck out. Statistically, that means 1 out of 7 times, 14% of the time, he's going to strike out. Is he succeeding or failing? I can answer that question for you. He signed a 3-year contract when he got traded, started this year, for $37,500,000 to play baseball for 3 years. So is he succeeding or failing? What do you think? See, comparatively to the other players, he's way ahead of the game. And everybody would want him, although some teams wouldn't have wanted him. And then I got to thinking, you know, his stats and my stats are sort of similar. Like, lots of times I get up and I never make the first base with you. You go home saying, what was that about? And about 1 in 7 times I just strike out with my sermon. And then I got to thinking, you know, if I have stats like him, I figure I must be worth about $37,500,000 over 3 years. That'd be $24,000 a sermon. $240,000 a sermon. About $34,000 a day. You know that guy makes $34,000 a day in baseball season and out of baseball season. Well, I got to thinking about that ever coming true in my life, and I figure this, it's sort of like the preferred rates at the bank. You might prefer them, but you ain't going to get them. You know, so I just put that to rest. But back to Murphy. He knows his stats better than we know his stats, don't you think? And I just wonder, after he gets 6 hits and he goes to the plate, what do you think he's thinking? I'm going to strike out. You think he's thinking that? I don't think he's thinking that. Because if he was thinking that, he probably would strike out. And I actually asked Bill Krupp to find out from Josh Krupp, our baseball expert, did Murphy ever strike out 2 times in a row in one game, consecutive strikeouts? And he did against the Pirates when he played for the Mets last October, I think it was. But can you imagine a guy batting a 4-11, striking out 2 times in a row and saying, I'm a failure! I'm never getting up again! I can't hit the ball anymore! Or if after a strikeout, you know, he walks to the plate and he's thinking, I'm afraid, I can't do this, I lost my time, you know, and if he lived by his fear or by the statistics, you think he'd even walk up to the plate again? And listen, if we fail once or twice in our life, we have this negative tendency to hem ourselves in like those 10 spies that look out there and say, it's a big world. We can't do it. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. See? So listen, here's a powerful point. Faith lifts the head again. You've got to see it as God sees it. See, here's a truth about life. There are some things you can do something about, and there are some things in life you can't do anything about. If you went bankrupt 10 years ago, then you went bankrupt. Quit blaming yourself for going bankrupt. And if you lost, you know, had a divorce 4 years ago, you got divorced. You got to move on. I mean, they're already, who knows? You see, you can't relive yesterday. Or if your kids didn't turn out exactly how you thought, or they don't seem to be turning out how you think they would have turned out, you just got to remember, it's not over till it's over. And that promise, I get it better than ever. It says, train up a child in the way he should go, and what? When he is old. And see, that doesn't even happen with everybody, because our kids have their own way too. But I'm just saying, sometimes we don't see what we planted in their lives until we're up in the years and they get a little smarter. And you think, it worked! You know, we did do something right. And so I just want you to say, faith is what gets you back in the game. Someone said it this way, a problem is something that can be solved. A fact is something that must be accepted. Now, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a theologian who started out somewhat gospel preacher and then became more of a liberal, and then as he got older, said, you know what, the ways of the Word seem to be right. He's the fellow who penned the Serenity Prayer. Lots of people know that. They think it comes from, you know, 12-step programs, but at least the beginning came from him. And it says this, God, grant me the peace to accept the things I cannot change. So just think about that. What about your life can you not change? You can't go back and undo it. People have made decisions for you. You lost your shirt. You know what? You did. Give me the serenity, the peace to accept the things I cannot change, and the courage to change the things that I can. Let me get back up to home plate, swinging that bat again. And then, God, give me the wisdom to know the difference. And see, I think that's so good. Because some of us are stuck trying to change things we don't have control over. See? And until you can say, Lord, I want to be smart enough to know which ones do I tackle and which ones do I just accept. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them or make them right. It just means there's not much I can do about that one. Second Corinthians 5:7. A verse I tell people all the time. I don't think they get it when I'm saying this. 2 Corinthians 5:7 says, "We live by faith, not by sight." And that's in reference to going home. But I don't mean this. Just conjure up a lot of faith and everything will be okay. Because we don't really define faith biblically like the Bible defines faith. See, read that faith chapter, Hebrews 11. It says, "By faith, people were beheaded." By faith, women watched their loved ones being sawn in two. You know, if you watch TV and try to define, by faith, I got a new car. By faith, I got a new job. By faith, I doubled my income in 3 days. That's not Bible faith. See, we live by faith, not by sight, when things are the worst and things are the best. And honestly, you know, like me, sometimes we think they're the best, and that's when they're the worst, because that's when we're walking away from God. And sometimes the hardest times are the best times. And I'm not saying let's think negatively and just live in the mess. I'm saying let's define faith as it says. And I just want to tell you, you're going through a hard time. You feel like a failure. We live by faith, not by sight. Don't you give up. Don't you predict tomorrow. You can't do that. Don't you decide the rest of my life is. That's not up to us. And then Hebrews 11:6, a verse in that faith chapter says, "And without faith it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to Him must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him." And after failure, I insert one word in that verse. It says, "And without faith it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to Him again." See, after I strike out, sometimes I mope a while to you. Sometimes I say, "God, where are you?" Sometimes I say, "Are the promises true?" But then when I walk back out there and I'm ready to do it again, I must believe that He's there and that He knows me and that His goal is reward. And, you know, like we saw in Jeremiah 29:11 last week, He doesn't have a plan to harm us. He has a plan for a hope and a future. Again. And so when you think it's over, it's not over. And when you're, you know, walking back up to try it again, know that we live by faith and not by sight. Now let's go in our Bibles to Mark chapter 14 and John 21. I want to do a little case study with you. This is just another man in the Bible who failed. Peter. Mark 14, verse 29 is where we'll start. And this is the scene where Jesus has met with His disciples and they all claimed they would follow Him. And Peter says, "Lord, even if they don't follow You, I will not fail You." Mark 14, verse 29. Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." And I think when he said that with a particular Peter kind of pride. And I think he was saying, "Lord, even if all," I think he meant all those other disciples, the other 10, because Judas had gone out by then, right? Had Judas gone out by then? Anybody know? I think so. Okay. And he said, "Lord, even if John and James and Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew, even if they, I will never fail you." And verse 30 says, "I tell you the truth," Jesus answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me 3 times. But Peter insisted emphatically. Now, of course, I don't know Peter, but we know a lot about him. But I could just see him swelling up. "I know you're God, but don't you tell me, because it won't happen." And he says, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all the others said the same. Now let's pick up in verse 53. And they took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and teachers of the law came together, and Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And there he sat with the guards and warmed himself with the fire. See, he was incognito. And he's there listening in. What are they going to do next? And he's warming himself by the fire. It says the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death, but they did not find any. And many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree with one another. Then some stood up and gave false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days we'll build another, not made by man. Yet even then their testimony did not agree. And then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing up against you? But Jesus remained silent and he gave no answer. And again the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming in the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? He asked. You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him, and they blindfolded him and struck him with their fists and said, prophesy! And the guards took him and beat him. While, verse 66, I would say meanwhile, Peter was below in the courtyard. And one of the servant girls of the high priest came by, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him and said, you also are with the Nazarene Jesus. But he denied it. Number one, I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said. And he went out into the entryway. And when the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, this fellow is one of them. And again he denied it. And after a little while, those standing near Peter said, surely you are one of them, for you're a Galilean. I think his language gave him away. And he began to call curses down on himself. And he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. And immediately, for the second time, and Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him, before the rooster crows twice, you'll disown me 3 times. And he broke down and he wept. Peter failed. Now let me ask you, was Peter a failure? We know he's not and wasn't. I mean, in the end, tradition says this is the guy who was to be crucified, and he said, listen, that's the way my Lord was crucified. Would you crucify me upside down? And they did. So he failed, but he wasn't a failure. Now let's go to John 21, because Jesus calls him out. John chapter 21, we'll pick up in verse 15. And this is a scene after Jesus' death and his burial and his resurrection, and he's appeared to other people, and he shows up at the Sea of Galilee up north. And that's where his disciples had gone. And if you remember, when the disciples were called, 4 of them especially, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, were all fishermen. And actually, it was Peter said, let's go fishing, boys. And they headed back up to the Sea of Galilee. And they had fished and caught nothing. And you might remember, Jesus was on the shore and he had made breakfast for his disciples. And they had breakfast together. Let's pick up in verse 15. It says, and when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter. Now, so's not in there, but here's what I hear. Like, so Simon, do you truly love me more than these? Now, lots of people would say that Jesus wasn't referring to the these as the rest of the disciples. I think that fits the picture the best. But it could be because Peter was a fisherman and went back to fishing. Maybe Jesus was looking at the boats and the nets and the trade and saying, so Peter, you know, I called you out of this before, and I'm about to do it again. You're going to follow me or you're going to be a fisherman? And that's when he said, be fishers of men, you know, previously. But anyhow, the picture's there. He denied Jesus three times. I think he thought he had a superior faith. And I tend to think it was like Peter. Here's the rest of the guys, and you were out fishing. You're just like them. So do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my lambs. And he denied him three times. He's reinstated three times. Let's go through the text because there's a wonderful play on words in the Greek language there. Jesus said to Peter, so Peter, do you have this all sacrificing, you know, give everything for me kind of love? That's called agape love. That's what Jesus says. Do you agape me? Do you love me like I love you? Because it was agape that had Jesus hang on the cross. That's the love of John 3:16. For God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believes on Him should not perish but have everlasting life. And Peter sure thought he had agape. But I think Peter ate some humble pie. See, when he pretended he didn't know Jesus, and then when he was crucified and buried and shows up on the seashore. And Jesus says, Peter, do you love me like that? And Peter said, Lord, you know I phileo you. That's like Philadelphia, brotherly love. That's where it comes from. He said, you know, Jesus, you know I'm your friend. See, I think Peter would have liked to stop and say, yes, Lord, I'll still die for you. I didn't turn my back on you. But Peter was lower than normal. Became a little real and said, Lord, you and I both know, and they know too. the best I can do is I love you like a friend. And look what Jesus says. So Peter, if that's true, then feed my lambs. See, he didn't say to him, does that sound like anybody's horn in here? Check your key fobs. Okay. He didn't say to him, Peter, when you can get it worked out, when you get back to where you can agape me, then come back and see me. I'll put you back to work. He just said, Peter, then feed my lambs. And again, a second time, Simon, son of John, do you truly agape me? And he said, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. He said, I'm just your friend. I want to be more. And Jesus says, well, take care of my sheep. And the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And do you know what Jesus asked him that time? Simon, son of John, are you my friend? See, that's why it says Peter was hurt. Because twice, do you agape me? Do you agape me? Peter said, I phileo. And then Jesus says, so do you phileo me? It's like, Lord, quit rubbing it in. And he said, Lord, you know all things. Like, quit asking me. You already know. Why are you making me, you know, reveal myself? I have failed. I get it. And Jesus said, well then, feed my sheep. And you know what I love about that passage? More than the play on words? God used Peter just as he was. He said, I can take that phileo love and put you back to work. And see, I think lots of times our failure comes as a result of our superior attitude toward our sold-outness toward God. Don't you? That we look around and think, you know, I'm here amongst these people, but they don't really understand how committed I am. You know, and I wouldn't do it that way. I'd do it this way. I'm Mr. Spiritual here. And sometimes Jesus has to just level it for us. And He says, when you get real, then I can use you. And so just get the picture. Jesus called His name again out of all those men. He said, hey, Peter, come here. And He does that to you and me. Like, we think, okay, I'm done. I'm off the hook. I was a failure. Never going back. But God never lets up. He's relentless. And He says, hey, get over here. I want to talk to you. And then we see that Jesus met him and He challenged him and he reinstated him, and then he reenlisted him to service and said, get back out there. And see, God does, and he will do the same for you and for me. So here's a little formula for you when you're coming out of failure. First of all, evaluate what happened. What kind of failure is this? Did it just come upon me, or was it part of my own doing? And no matter what, understand and believe that past failures do not determine your future. Nick Vujicic, the fellow we watched the video of last week, says this. He says, my future is not held hostage by my circumstance. And then acknowledge. See, evaluate, then admit it to yourself, to God, and to others. Don't make excuses for your sin. Call sin, sin, if sin's involved. And then do that inward examination and know that God is more interested in changing your heart than changing your circumstance. And then agree with God. That's called confess. And receive God's grace and forgiveness. Everybody do this with me. I'll do it first and you do it with me. Ready? One, two, three. I feel better already, don't you? If you've been here a long time, you know what I'm going to say next. The best counselor in the world that I ever had, the best worldly counselor, after he got tired of listening to me, he'd go, and I knew it was over then. That counselor was a German Shepherd dog named Duke. And when Mom and Dad were going through a divorce and I was mad at God and the world and trying to figure it all out, I'd lay in bed and I'd talk to Duke. He'd come in my room and I had one of those braided oval rugs and he'd do three or four circles and lay down, you know. And I'd talk to him as if he could answer me. And after a while he'd go, lay down and go to sleep. But I thought, why don't I do that? Why don't I just breathe it in and then let it go? You know, and I just think there's some real freedom in doing that because you got to move on. You got to hear what God's saying, that He says it's okay. But can you imagine David? How bad did it get? He said, my tears are my food day and night. When will I ever go back to church and lead the procession up the hill? That's what David said. And do you know, I'm going to preach a sermon on this one. When Absalom, his son, who was, you know, got revenge on his brother that raped his sister, and then he was going to take over his dad's kingdom, and when he lost his life, as much as David was released, he grieved, Absalom, Absalom, my son. And I just have to say, it goes deep, see? We can't even figure it all out when it's happening to us. And then I just want you to say, sometimes repentance, sometimes restitution, sometimes reconciliation is needed in our failures. Sometimes you've got to go say, I'm sorry, because it was your fault. Or even your reaction to the failure included some sin. And sometimes you've got to go back and say, I want to make this right. You've got to make reconciliation with people and with God, of course. And then it's time to move past the failure. Now, I don't mean move on. I mean move past. Because I'm not saying move on, you know, have an ex-wife, never talk to her again, you know, whatever it might be. You move past it. You don't live in the past. It's part of your story. Failure is part of your story. But you don't live in the failure. You move past it. And then lastly today, faith-filled fortitude says, get out there and go for God again. See, that's how you get up to plate after you strike out. Well, 37,500,000 helps, but, you know, you got to get back out there. You got to come out of the dugout and face the pitcher. We have to learn to see it as God sees it. Listen, what is success really? Here's my best definition for success. Living under the glory of God no matter the circumstance. And so lots of things that we call success aren't real success anyhow. Now here's a good word about starting over again. This quote comes from Thomas Edison. Thomas Edison invented lots of things. He invented the phonograph, the motion picture camera, and the light bulb. But he failed more than he was successful. And here's what he said. I have not failed. I just found 10,000 ways that won't work. Isn't that good? And we may not have his spirit and his personality and his inventiveness, but we can take that attitude. Psalm 40, verses 1 to 3, say this, I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me. He inclined His ear to me. He inclined His vision to me. And He heard my cry. And He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and He set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. That's the guy who failed. But see, this thinking is why he's the guy who's known as the man after God's own heart, because he said, I was stuck in the pit, and God pulled me up. He got me out of the quicksand, and He put me on the mountain. Now I want to share with you a reading. This is my favorite piece of non-biblical literature. And I don't submit it as Scripture, but I submit it as practical, workable advice. This piece of literature is called If by Rudyard Kipling. And it says, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise, if you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools, if you can make one heap of all of your winnings and risk it with one turn of pitch and toss and lose, and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there's nothing left within you except the will which says, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son. I've got to tell you, besides the Bible, that's had the biggest influence on my life. Sometimes you just do it because you're going to do it. And you've got to grit your teeth and you've got to go on. No matter what everybody else says, no matter how it feels, you know what's right. And you got to pick up what's left over and start moving. So listen. As I close, I would say my best advice, when you fail, when you're in the middle of the failure, while you're down, when you're starting to look up, when you're walking to the plate, always run to God. Never run from God. James chapter 4, verses 6 to 10 says this, but He gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and He will lift you up. See, God's not surprised by any sin. God's not surprised by any failure. God's not surprised. There's nothing new under the sun. And He says, hey, come here. We go humbly before Him. He says, let's make this right. I want to leave an idea with you. Remember I said Adam, as far as I can see, was the greatest failure in the Bible? Listen to these verses from Romans chapter 5. It says, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, who was that? Adam. And death through sin, who brought death to all the world? Adam. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. For before the law was given, sin was in the world, but sin is not taken into account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin, who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who was the pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass. For if the many died by the trespass of the one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to many. Adam's failure was not final. God said, you're in the plan. This is part of the process here. From the foundation of the world, God intended for Jesus to yield His life on the cross. And it was Adam who took it away and Jesus who paid the price to bring it back. And it says again, the gift of God is not like the result of one man's sin. The judgment followed one sin and brought condemnation, but the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespass of one man death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and the gift of righteousness reign in the life of the one man, Jesus Christ? And so I just want to say, see, God even used the failure of Adam to bring about the cross of Jesus, our hope. And listen, our identification in the flesh is with Adam. But in the Spirit is with Jesus, the great overcomer. So remember, everybody fails sometimes. Failure is not final. So lift your head and let God begin again in your life.